Across Australia, you're listening to ABC Radio National.
Good morning, this is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. The federal government is wheeling out another plank of its hospitals overhaul plan today, promising almost $750 million to take over aged care. The Commonwealth is proposing to take over full responsibility for aged care for the first time. It would fund an extra 2,500 aged care places with zero interest loans. But there is a catch, as with yesterday's $500 million pledge to slash hospital emergency waiting times, the lion's share of the aged care money is contingent on the Premier's signing up to Kevin Rudd's health plan at next week's Council of Australian Governments meeting. The Minister for Ageing, Justine Elliott, has been speaking with Alexandra Kirk in Canberra.
The Rudd government's making a major investment, $730 million in aged care, to better support our older Australians and to also take pressure off our hospitals. And this investment will support around 5,000 aged care places or beds right across the nation. So this will really ease the pressure on our hospital system and, very importantly, be providing more services for older Australians regardless of where they may live.
Well, you're saying that you're going to end the blame game, but what practical difference will people feel?
Well, look, at the moment, it can be really, really hard for older people to find and access the services they do require because it is very fragmented. The Commonwealth, of course, currently runs and regulates all the nursing home places and all the Commonwealth-funded community care packages that people have in their homes. We also fund 60% of home and community care, but the states currently deliver that. So what we're saying is we'll take over full funding and policy responsibility when it comes to aged care so we can create a really seamless transition for people in terms of them actually accessing those aged care services right from the very beginning of those most basic home care services they might require, like assistance with home maintenance or lawn mowing, right through to very high-level clinical residential care. So it is a seamless system for them so that older Australians can actually access those services a lot easier.
The money's being spread out over 4 years, but how quickly will people see a real improvement in older Australians getting a place in an aged care facility rather than being admitted to a hospital when they don't need to be?
Well, look, in the very near future, hopefully, we've got a commitment, a major commitment, and that funding will be flowing very soon, and I certainly would call upon the states to support us to firstly ensure we've got better services provided to older Australians and secondly to also take the pressure off our hospitals.
Will the extra money flow even if the states don't sign up to Kevin Rudd's health and hospitals plan?
Look, I'm saying that this particular funding that we've made in relation to aged care is there because it's so important to provide those services. What I'm saying, particularly when it comes to the issues surrounding home and community care, that we'll be looking for the support from the states to ensure we can have that transition period. Obviously, all of these issues are ones that are going to be discussed at COAG.
So if they say no to the federal takeover of health and hospital care in a week's time, part or all of this funding won't go ahead?
Well, I don't think we can preempt what they may or may not be saying at COAG. Certainly we'll be looking for their support, particularly when it comes to home and community care. But as I say, we've got these major commitments in place when it comes to aged care.
The Federal Minister for Ageing, Justine Elliott, speaking to Alexandra Kirk. The Rudd government sees health reform as a key plank to winning the next election, so it's unlikely to be pleased with the views of one of the nation's foremost business figures who has come out strongly against Kevin Rudd's plans to take more control over funding hospitals. Retired businessman Roger Corbett used to be boss of Woolworths. He's now the chairman-elect of Kids New South Wales, the body which runs the Randwick and Westmead Children's Hospitals in Sydney. Mr Corbett has told Simon Santo from AM that the Prime Minister is making a mess of much-needed reforms and he risks making the system worse than it already is.
What Kevin Rudd has done in the last few weeks has greatly confused the picture by announcing a provision of bursaries here and another provision over there, and today $500 million for outpatients or emergency services. We don't want to have a piecemeal solution. The Australian public are entitled to a comprehensive answer, and they're not getting it.
So do you have sympathy for the premiers of New South Wales and Victoria when they are refusing to sign up to the plan until they see more details?
I think that Christine Keneally and John Brumby have an absolute responsibility to their electorates in New South Wales and Victoria to stand up. as they're doing so.
The Prime Minister says he's going to remove bureaucracy in his restructure. Is that the reality as far as you're aware?
Well, if he's going to do so, then Premier Brumby and Premier Keneally are entitled to know what the structure is and how that will occur. I think on the basis of what the Prime Minister has announced is likely to have exactly the opposite effect.
So when the Prime Minister says he's going to return decision-making to the grassroots by instituting area health boards, what is your view on whether that's effective or not?
Well, I think the plan and the number of districts that he's planning to do is, quite frankly, entirely wrong. And you're going to end up with some districts with, half a dozen hospitals with 5 beds in each type of style, which is just ridiculous. You need to have a balance between government management and local boards in order to ensure, it's okay to have a local board if you're prepared to let the business go broke, as you do in free enterprise. But you can't afford to allow a public hospital go broke. You've got to have some balance between government responsibility and control through a well-run and efficient bureaucracy, I believe at state level, not as federal level, and local participation. But the government cannot abdicate its responsibility to local committees or groups or so on.
Now, you made your reputation heading up Woolworths. You're also on some other major boards, not the least of which the Reserve Bank Board of Australia. Do you expect the government to take your criticism without retribution?
Oh, well, if the government were as small-minded as to exercise retribution against me personally, so be it. I feel I've got a responsibility as an informed member of the community in the interests of medicine, particularly medicine for children of our state, to speak up and give a point of view.
Roger Corbett, Chairman-elect of Kids New South Wales, which runs Sydney's 2 children's hospitals. He was speaking there to Simon Santo, and the full interview of that, that full interview can be seen and heard on our website later this morning. You're listening to AM Around Australia on Radio National, where it's just gone 17 minutes past 7. World leaders have begun arriving in Washington for an unprecedented summit to secure nuclear stockpiles and keep weapons material out of the hands of terrorists. The White House says US President Barack Obama has called the 47-nation conference to tackle what it describes as the most dangerous threat to the world. President Obama will also have a series of meetings on the sidelines of the summit, aimed in part at trying to win support for new sanctions against Iran. Washington correspondent Kim Landers reports.
The Nuclear Security Summit is the biggest gathering of world leaders on US soil in 65 years. President Barack Obama wants leaders to agree to secure all nuclear materials within 4 years, and he's also likely to call for tougher prosecutions of traffickers in weapons-grade materials. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the fear of a nuclear war between superpowers has waned, replaced by the threat of nuclear-armed terrorists.
We know that terrorist groups, primarily Al-Qaeda, persist in their efforts to obtain enough nuclear material to try to do something that would cause just such mass havoc and terror and damage and destruction that it would be devastating.
This summit comes a week after the US signed a new arms control treaty with Russia and unveiled a new policy about the use of nuclear weapons. But this meeting will focus on separated plutonium and highly enriched uranium.
There's a lot of nuclear material that is not as secure. It hasn't been destroyed. It isn't under lock and key in many places in the world, particularly in the former Soviet Union, but not exclusively there.
Nuclear expert Joe Cirincione says President Obama will have his work cut out for him.
India and Pakistan don't really agree that the number one task is to secure their nuclear materials. They're part of the crowd you want to convince.
Although the summit doesn't officially start until tomorrow, President Obama has already begun a series of one-on-one meetings with several leaders, including nuclear rivals India and Pakistan. He's also hoping to use a meeting tomorrow with China's president to win support for new sanctions against Iran. Meanwhile, the US Defense Secretary Robert Gates says Iran is not a nuclear-capable country at the moment, nor does he think it's inevitable that Iran will become one. Some world leaders will not be at the summit, including Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He's sending his deputy instead, and Hillary Clinton denies that's a snub.
Gordon Brown is not coming from Great Britain. Kevin Rudd is not coming from Australia. King Abdullah is not coming from Saudi Arabia.
Defence Minister John Faulkner will represent Australia. This is Kim Landers in Washington for AM.
In Thailand, the opposition red shirt protesters are showing no signs of backing down, even though weekend clashes left at least 19 people dead and hundreds injured. One of those killed was Japanese cameraman Hiroyuki Murimoto, who worked for the ABC in Asia in the 1990s before joining the Reuters news agency. Also killed were soldiers and protesting civilians. Protesters accused security forces of using live ammunition, an allegation the government denies. Our correspondent Mark Willisey filed this report from the site of the bloodshed.
Well, I'm in the historic old district of Bangkok. This is the stronghold of the red shirts. This is where the battle was between the army and the protesters. It started out with the army and the soldiers using rubber bullets and tear gas to try to disperse the protesters. But someone then started firing live rounds, and those live rounds were fired into the crowd. Hundreds were injured. The red shirts are showing no sign of leaving. They're still here in numbers, and it would seem that force is not going to be an effective weapon for the Thai army to try and disperse this protest.
The army tried to disperse us. We had no weapons, so many red shirts were injured and killed because they have used force. The only option for us is to fight back.
Having failed to push the protesters back or disperse them in any way, the army has now basically conceded that force is not going to work. And there are reports this morning that the army has called for a truce with the protesters, some sort of ceasefire, in an effort maybe that talks can restart and some sort of solution can be found through compromise, not confrontation. This woman is showing us basically bullet casings that have been found on the ground around here. There's assault rifle casings, also what appears to be 12-gauge shotgun casings. She's making allegations that these were obviously fired into the red shirt crowd, and she's got a friend here who has sustained a bullet wound to his upper bicep. So the allegations are that the army did willingly and knowingly fire into this crowd. This protest has now been dragging on for 4 weeks, and there are calls now for the king to intervene, like he did in 1992 when the last great eruption of violence hit Bangkok. But there are some big questions remaining over the health of the king and whether he can actually intervene and make any difference to end this crisis.
It would be really good if the king would step in. We really want to end this and go home.
I'm standing in the shadow of the Democracy Monument in old part of Bangkok, and I'm surrounded by APCs, armoured personnel carriers, that the Thai army has just abandoned. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And there's a little bit of tension in the crowd here at the moment. People are trying to calm people down. People are trying to smash army tracks and also the APCs. So we might just move on out of here, I think. The military has pulled right back from this red shirt stronghold, and for now it seems like neither compromise nor confrontation is working. This is Mark Willisey reporting from the red shirt stronghold in the old city of Bangkok for AM.
The body of Polish President Lech Kaczynski has been delivered back to a nation overcome with grief. Hundreds of thousands of mourners lined the streets of Warsaw to watch the motorcade and pay their last respects. The President, the First Lady of Poland, and more than 90 members of Poland's political and cultural elite were killed when their plane crashed in Western Russia at the weekend. Europe correspondent Emma Alberici.
There was 2 minutes of silence, and after a short religious ceremony at Warsaw Airport, bells tolled throughout the capital as the motorcade wound its way to the presidential palace. Many among the hundreds of thousands who came to watch the cortege threw flowers at Lech Kaczynski's hearse.
Even I was not a big fan of Mr. President. I think that it was a huge person for us, and I'm really shocked.
I can't believe it, what's happened. It was a very horrible message for our nation.
When the president's body arrived at the palace, Marta Kaczynski, his only child, was there to greet it. She stood alongside her uncle, Jarosław Kaczynski, the president's twin brother. The body is now lying in state, and the country has begun an official 7 days of mourning. The Polish president was making his way to a forest in western Russia whose name evokes the worst memories of his country's troubled past. Katyn was the place where the entire Polish leadership, more than 21,000 of them, was wiped out by the Soviet Union in one of the worst atrocities of World War II. It's a bitter irony that 70 years later, Lech Kaczynski died on his way to commemorate their deaths. On board the plane with him were family members of those killed in Katyn. The presidential jet was also carrying the First Lady of Poland, the Chief of the Polish Army, the head of the Central Bank, leaders of the main opposition parties, as well as the Deputy Foreign Minister. His boss, Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski, is struck by the timing of this national tragedy.
There was a mood of optimism for the first time, and this tragedy has brought forward the worst nightmares of our history.
For the first time in its history, Poland is where it's fought so hard to be. At the centre of the European Union, an influential voice on the world stage, a close friend of the United States, a member of NATO, and the only country among the 27 members of the EU that did not fall into recession during the economic slump of the last 2 years. Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk has called the plane crash the worst disaster for his country since the Second World War. Norman Davies, an expert on Polish history from Oxford University, agrees.
I don't think there's any equivalent in Europe, or I'm not certain whether anywhere in the world the country has lost so many leaders in one blow.
Within 2 weeks, acting President Bronislaw Komorowski will set a date for a new presidential election. This is Emma Alberici reporting for AM.
Earlier this year, big summer rain saturated large parts of central Australia, and Alice Springs received more than its average yearly rainfall in just 1 week. The water has transformed the usually arid bush landscape. The Red Centre now has a carpet of green and the desert is full of life. Sarah Everingham compiled this report for AM from Alice Springs.
At the Alice Springs Desert Park, the curator of botany, Scott Polibelink, has been watching the changing colours of the desert.
It's a really exciting time out here.
In the first 2 months of this year, more than 400 millimetres of rain fell in the centre of Alice Springs.
It's just a total transformation. It's like the whole country's put on a different coat.
Leah Lawton, an Indigenous woman from the Alice Springs area, works as a guide at the park.
All of the grasses are starting to shoot, like the kangaroo grasses, the native mullet grasses, which were used traditionally to make damper and bread and stuff like that.
She says the rain has produced an abundance of bush foods and medicine.
The native apple bush is starting to come up. That's used for colds and stuff. And a lot of that limestone rock fuchsia is starting to come up.
And what's that for?
That's used for washing your body if you got sores on your body and stuff like that.
But Leah Lawton says just as soon as the plants shoot up, they're ravaged by insects and the bird life now flourishing in the desert.
Yeah, so we've got to beat all the birds. And not only with that, all the grasshoppers are out, so they've stripped a few of our langua bushes, our bush bananas, so that's really unfortunate.
This year's rain came after Alice Springs recorded its driest year on record last year. The downpour was a huge relief for pastoralists. The executive director of the Northern Territory Cattlemen's Association, Luke Bowen, says some stations in the centre had been in drought for up to 8 years. Many had been forced to destock their properties.
It's great to see the country down in central Australia now. It's really rebounded and looks fantastic, and the spirits of people there have significantly improved. It's amazing to see the difference that looks on people's faces, the smiles and the general optimism that follows rain.
If the rain continues, Scott Polibelink from the Alice Springs Desert Park says it will add even more colours to the landscape.
If this rain keeps going on into autumn and spring, we'll end up with carpets of wildflowers.
He says it's been almost 10 years since the last major wildflower event in the area.
So it just tells you how remarkable those species are, that the seed can remain in the soil for that long, just waiting for the right climatic conditions at the right time of the year.
Scott Polibelink from the Alice Springs Desert Park, ending Sarah Everingham's report. To the financial markets now, and the Australian dollar is buying 93.8 US cents. That's up nearly half a cent on Friday's close. It's buying 87.3 Japanese yen and 68.8 euro cents. West Texas Intermediate crude oil is closing on $85 a barrel. Tapis crude in Singapore is at $86.5 US dollars. Spot gold is up, currently $1,157 US dollars. That's up $12 on last week's close. I'm Tony Yeastley, and that's AM for today.